When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about the end game for the British campaign in the Middle East in 1918 against the Ottoman Empire. By late 1918, it was increasingly clear that the Central Powers had a very short time left to wage the war. Following the fall of Bulgaria in late September 1918, the entire eastern part of the Central Powers began to waver and crumble. The problem with losing Bulgaria was that oil supplies from Romania were imperiled to Austria and Germany. It also put the Ottoman Empire in a very difficult position as well. The Ottoman Empire had fought a surprisingly good war. The British and the French, in typical colonial fashion, had written off the Turkish army. However, under the guidance of German officers and retooled with German weapons, the Turkish army from 1912 onwards reorganises itself into an impressive fighting force. Disasters inflicted upon the British and the French at Gallipoli and on the British and Indian soldiers at Kut Alamara in 1916, both show that the Ottoman Empire had a lot of fight left in it. However, 1916 is really the high point of Ottoman power and fighting prowess in the Middle East. And from thereafter, there is a period of steady decline. The campaigns that the Ottomans fought against the British had cost them irreplaceable troops. One of the great strengths of the British Army during the war is its ability, using domestic and colonial troops, to keep replenishing itself. In the two theatres where the British were chiefly concerned, Palestine and Mesopotamia, the British were able to pour in resources, and they had marched on Jerusalem in November and December 1917. Though the opposition then had been determined and had cost the British 18,000 casualties, the next big offensive in Palestine, at Megiddo, was in September 1918, and this swept away Ottoman resistance. There was a swift rout, and three quarters of the enemy's forces were captured. So between December 1917 and September 1918, there had been a decline in the manpower of both armies in order to satisfy the needs of other theatres and other fronts. But the Ottomans ran their forces down far greater. One of the things that lures the Ottomans away from the fight with the British is the potential for a vast land grab on the northern border with Russia as a result of the October Revolution in October 1917. From February 1918 onwards, the Ottomans were marching into the Russian Transcaucasia, and this fragmented into Armenia, Azerbaijan and Georgia. Half the army was in the region by September 1918, including some of the best fighting units. And it looks as if, there was one great strategic blunder by the Ottomans during the war, this surely must have been it. The Palestine force that the Ottomans had lost its German advisors and its most able officers as a result of the needs of the German army during 1918, specifically the Ludendorff offensives on the Western Front. In order to deal with the Ludendorff offensive, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, led by General Allenby, had to transfer basically two infantry divisions and 23 battalions, 9 regiments, as well as artillery and other equipment to the Western Front. And in return, they were given 54 Indian battalions, though many of those had not seen any military service so far. They were poorly trained and didn't have the skills for specialised tasks, such as signalling, demolitions, artillery, or gunning, machine gunning. So Allenby was worried that this would hold up the advance and damage the British standing in Egypt, which perhaps the British were not fully aware of, but their standing in Egypt was fairly abysmal and would remain so until the British left Egypt finally in the 1950s. So in David Stevenson's brilliant book, With Our Backs to the Wall, which explains the final year of fighting, 1918, he quotes Allenby saying, "The situation in Egypt is that we are surrounded by an alien and unfriendly people. The natives are nearly all anti-British." Allenby requested to see whether Japan, an ally of Britain, would deploy troops to the Middle East, to which there was surprise at Whitehall and an almost resounding no. The understanding that the British had fairly accurately of Japan was that Japan was interested in its own theatre within the Pacific and Asia, and very little else. The desperate British government in London was determined to transfer as many troops as possible to the Western Front, and were hoping to move the final all-British division that Allenby had, and also the Australian Mounted Division, which had been of immense use during the campaigns in Egypt and Palestine. And Allenby was frank in his estimations and said that ultimately this would constitute a serious risk. There would be too few troops to hold the line or to maintain a contact with the Arab revolt of T.E. Lawrence in the Hejaz, which is now Saudi Arabia, and that there was the possibility even of losing Egypt, perhaps from a revolt within Egypt or a successful Ottoman expedition into Egypt. And this would, of course, have deprived the British of the control of the Suez Canal. Had this happened, then the British Empire would certainly have been fragmented or even lost. Allenby got to keep his troops, and then during the summer of 1918, when there was comparatively little action, the troops got to rest and train. The Indian soldiers were brought up to a level of skill that would have been important for the forthcoming campaign, and the Turkish troops were on the other side of the line didn't have any of these kinds of benefits. The material strains upon the Ottoman Empire were showing, and the Turkish army was suffering from a kind of attrition due to hunger and illness. One key thing that comes up here, and I was writing about this for a magazine article the other year, it was the public health initiatives that were happening at the time, or the kind of military health initiatives, particularly regarding malaria. So the British Army drained swampland and made sure that their troops stationed in the Jordan Valley were protected from malaria. The Ottomans didn't do this. Previously, in other campaigns, during the Boer War, for example, the Royal Army Medical Corps and medical officers in general were seen as a kind of an annoying inconvenience. You go back as far as the Crimea, and the Crimea is the moment in which that medicine as a kind of a means of fighting war, keeping the troops fit and healthy so they can wage war, becomes a key public issue. More people, more soldiers are lost to typhus and cholera in the Crimean War than any other cause. And it was only during the First World War when suddenly there was such an enormous demand for manpower that everybody counted, every man counted, that suddenly generals begin to listen to doctors. And you have people like Douglas Haig, Sir John French, actually inviting colonels from the Royal Army Medical Corps to dinner to talk to them, because they understood, it began to dawn on them that cholera was just as dangerous, or malaria was just as dangerous to winning or losing the campaign as the enemy. Fresh troops and adequate healthcare and food meant that by September of 1918, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force enjoyed a 2-to-1 advantage in manpower over the Ottoman forces. This was meant they had 12,000 cavalry, 57,000 infantry, 540 artillery pieces, against 3,000 cavalry, 26,000 troops, and 370 cannons, respectively. And the British also managed to command Prince Faisal of later of Iraq, but Prince Faisal, his Northern Arab Army, that was principally under the control of, or the orders of, Edmund Allenby, but was advised by T.E. Lawrence and his other liaison officers. And this meant that the Arab revolt could be coordinated from Allenby's headquarters. Now, at this time, many of the key deceptions of the British regarding the outcome of the Arab revolt was starting to become increasingly clear. Sharif Hussein of Mecca, Faisal's father, who had been given certain ambiguous guarantees by British officer Henry McMahon, which were also contrary to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which had offered Syria and Lebanon to France and Iraq and the rest of Mesopotamia to the British.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight.
Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And also the emergence in late 1917 of the Balfour Declaration, which had offered to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, ran contrary to what Sharif Hussein believed that he had been promised, which was a united Arab nation. The British, eventually becoming disconcerted with Sharif Hussein's complaints, as they saw it, decided that it might be better to back his rival, Ibn Saud, who would later form the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. However, as the troop numbers dwindled for Allenby, he suddenly began to look upon the contribution of the Arabs as being more and more important. Losing men to the Western Front had given the Arabs a little bit more leverage. So the Arabs had managed to kill, wound or capture, or simply immobilise in the desert by destroying trains, 25,000 Ottoman soldiers. But the weakening bonds between Allenby and Sharif Hussein and Faisal meant that there was a time pressure involved in finally breaking the Ottoman Empire. Allenby, relying on the Arab contribution, started to see that the Arab contribution might be withdrawn at some point in the not-too-distant future. On the 19th of September 1918, Allenby's attack on the Ottomans in the remainder of Palestine and Jordan began. Not only were the Ottoman forces outnumbered on the ground, but also the British had air superiority, and they were able to use infantry, superior tactics from Allenby, who had managed to convince the Ottomans he was going to march inland, whereas in reality he marched up the coast, and the use of a horse division, mounted division, in order to surround the Ottomans. By the end of the first 3 days of the offensive, the Turkish command and control at Nazareth had collapsed. And by the 21st of September, 25,000 prisoners from the Turkish 8th Army had been captured, and both the 7th and the 4th Turkish armies had fled into disorganised chaos. The Arab forces under Sharif Hussein had at that point managed to destroy the railway line to Damascus, so the retreat couldn't even be done via train, it had to be done on foot. The city of Damascus was captured on the 1st of October, with British troops marching in, and then by the 8th of October, the city of Beirut had fallen to the British. And this meant that the British now had both Haifa in Palestine and Beirut in what would soon be Lebanon, as sources of docks and ports for British warships. The scale of the victory and the rapidity of the victory had exhausted Allenby's army. Supply lines were overstretched. 75,000 troops in total had been captured, including 3,500 German soldiers. And this was out of an army of about 105,000. And this meant that Allenby had to pause. the Turks were able to dig in at Aleppo, creating another line of defences to keep the British at bay, hoping that they could drag it out into a long war of attrition. The total British losses for the campaign were 5,666, which David Stevenson rightly points out could have been suffered by the British army on the Western Front in one day. The British started with bigger numbers and they were better equipped. But surely some credit has to go to Allenby for the skill with which he managed to outmaneuver the Ottomans and to effectively encircle their armies. Perhaps looking through the history of the British Army in the First World War, the campaign to seize Damascus might be looked at as the British Army's most successful initiative. The situation in Mesopotamia, what would now be modern-day Iraq, was really quite different. Not only had the government deprioritised the British Army in Mesopotamia in favour of Allenby in Palestine, but there were a number of key logistical problems and difficulties already there pre-existing. That said, the problems that faced the Turks were vastly greater in Mesopotamia, and this is what decides the outcome. So, in early 1918, General Jan Smuts, the South African statesman and later Prime Minister, decided that at the British War Cabinet, that the army in Mesopotamia, led by General Sir William Marshall, should not be as prioritised as Allenby's forces, and that Mesopotamia was perhaps something of a sideshow. In 1918, General Marshall was also forced to divide his forces between Mesopotamia and sending some of them to support one of the British Army's real kind of sideshows in Persia and the north end of the Caspian Sea, which was run by General Lionel Dunsterville, referred to as Dunster Force. The forces in Mesopotamia had to send a supply line of 750 lorries, which tied up nearly all of the Mesopotamian army's transport, and send those full of supplies and equipment and sometimes troops all the way to reinforce Dunster Force in northern Persia. The terrain, having been there myself, is notoriously difficult and mountainous and problematic for anybody traversing that region, let alone a force in kind of rickety trucks in 1918. The problem, therefore, was in dealing with the Ottoman forces in that area. But the crises that the Ottoman Empire had gone into in the previous 18 months was really quite telling. In 18 months earlier, in mid-1916, as I said, the Ottoman Empire dealt Britain a terrible blow at Kut Al Amara, besieging the British army and eventually forcing its surrender with terrible suffering involved. But by late 1918, the entire garrison in Mesopotamia eventually surrendered to General Marshall. This is 15,000 troops when he marched up the Euphrates River. And in April 1917, 17,000 Turkish troops had already died of disease and hunger. And what that tells you is that these outposts of the Ottoman Empire were where large numbers of men were dying of starvation and dying of disease, were really kind of canaries in the mine for the Ottoman Empire itself. They were the ones that showed the ill health of the Ottoman Empire overall, economically and strategically. Following the surrender of Bulgaria, it became clear to the British that the Ottomans might seek terms at any time, and therefore Marshall should now strive to capture as much territory as possible, always useful when you're entering peace negotiations. Marshall said that the transport shortages as a result of the of Dunster Force made it very difficult to make it all the way up the Tigris or the Euphrates River. And the cabinet was desperate to seize Mosul at all costs. I think I've mentioned before Lloyd George's obsession with Mosul, knowing what came out of the ground there, principally oil. The British had made it as far up the Tigris River as Tikrit, famously the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and the battle north of Tikrit on the 23rd to the 24th of October saw the Turks once again outflanked and defeated. On the 30th, the Turkish armistice was signed, and the entire force at on the River Tigris surrendered. And the Sixth Army, the Turkish Sixth Army, was all but destroyed at this point. 11,000 prisoners were taken by the British, who had lost 1,866 troops into the bargain, and they managed to seize Mosul. Which was the central town in the Mesopotamian oil region, which fell into British hands and was perhaps the greatest material prize of the entire war. Okay, well, thanks. I hope you found that useful, and we'll be returning to the First World War in the Middle East, no doubt, in the near future. Please, if you can, check out our Patreon page. The podcast really runs on a shoestring, and every donation helps, and we're in one of those lean periods at the moment. So yes, give us a look on the Patreon page if you can. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.